What's up? Welcome to Canucks Talk for another week here on Sportsnet 650. I'm Jamie Dodd, my co-host. Back in studio, he is Thomas Drance. He covers the team for The Athletic as well. We're broadcasting live from the Kintec studio. Kintec Footwear and Orthotics working together with you in step. 650, 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. And this hour of Canucks Talk is brought to you by Rack Steel. You need forklifts that perform under pressure and pallet racking that maximizes your space. Visit them online at racksteel.com. What's going on, Drance?
It is draft lottery day.
That's true. It is.
Did you forget?
No, I remembered.
The annual holiday of Canucks disappointment.
Yeah, although this one, it's like, it doesn't even qualify. I guess if you drop to 16, it's like that's just the ultimate kick in the teeth.
I guess. But even the stakes whatever. There are meaningless.
Very, very low.
I think the actual stakes are just that if they don't move up, I feel like we're going to really expect them to trade that first.
Yes.
Or at the very least, we should really expect them to trade that first.
Yes. Do you think Canucks management is like, we don't really want to move up. We want to trade this pick. It'd be a lot easier to trade this pick if we're at 15.
Well, they might be in the mode where it's like, we should trade the pick because, or even if we move up, it's just more value
to
trade.
We just get a better guy then if we trade it. Perfect.
Although I would imagine, because the thing about this draft class is kind of a six-player draft. Now, really, it's a one-player draft. Everyone knows Nolan Schaefer is going to go first.
Matthew Schaefer.
What did I say?
Nolan.
My bad. And then everyone knows Matthew Schaefer is going to go first. Nolan Schaefer, who's that?
I have no idea. I have no idea what that's a reference to.
Peter Schaefer is going to go first and then be traded for Sammy Salo. Okay, so sorry. So Matthew Schaefer, everyone knows he'll go first. And then there's this class of like a few guys, but I think Martone and Misa would kind of be like a pretty clear 2-3.
Nolan Schaefer, by the way, played 7 games for the San Jose Sharks.
Oh, so he is
a player. Goalie. In the 05-06 season.
I don't know why that name got lodged in my head.
That's a great question. That was the extent of his NHL experience.
Okay, Nolan Schaefer.
There you go.
I'm remembering a guy I don't even remember.
Yep.
And then, anyway, you get down, but there's those two guys, the Swedish centerman and Denoyer, the French-Canadian centerman, the Q centerman, who are, like, legit going to play NHL, going to play center at the next level. These guys aren't like centers at junior might end up on the wing.
Yep.
They're like true centers. That's pretty interesting if you end up at 5, I think. So those are the stakes for the Canucks. Maybe you get a center.
There you go.
Or maybe you have more artillery
trade the
to trade.
To get a center. One way or another, you're getting a center, you hope, with this draft pick, wherever it lands.
They have to get a center.
All right, we will talk to Harmon Dial coming up at 1 o'clock, but there is a lot to dig into, both with the Canucks, somewhat surprisingly, and also, of course, from around the NHL. So let's go to the whiteboard.
All right, now, fellas. Hey, let's focus up, huh?
It is your daily deep dive into what's up with the Canucks and the NHL for today, May 5th. We'll start with the headlines. Now, I want to lead with the Stanley Cup playoffs and the headline that the first round of the playoffs is done in the books after a pair of wild game sevens over the weekend.
This weekend was peak hockey.
And the Mikko Rantanen game, the Mikko Rantanen period, and really the end of that series, games 5 through 7, he was a force to be reckoned with against his former team, culminating in the 2 goals to mount the comeback in the third period of game 7, setting up the winner. Yeah.
Okay, the first one was one of the nastiest individual efforts you will see, and like the number one exhibit of why when a goal gets scored and fans of the opposition team watch the highlight looking for who to blame on their own team, and like sometimes you should just tip your cap to the fact that one of the coolest people in the world did one of the coolest things possible on an ice sheet. That entry, it's like there's no positional error. There's no missed check.
Yeah.
There's no missed assignment. There's no bad save. It's a perfect bar down shot. That's like the perfect example of a play where you just got to tip your cap. And then the second goal, which is, bounces in off a Colorado defender's skate, his foot's on the end boards as he's sort of twerking around the net to get the wrap.
Did you say he was twerking around the net?
Yeah, twisting himself while working. Around the net.
I think twerking means something else.
Oh, what is it? Can you give me a demonstration?
Mikko Rantanen twerks around the net. What? Never heard that before. Twerking around? Is that what you were thinking? Like he was twerking himself?
Are you sure, like, or twerking? Right. Okay. Are you sure twerk is not a word?
I mean, it is a word. I just don't think it means what you think it means.
A dance or a dance move involving thrusting. Okay, so I wouldn't say he twerked around. That would have been a highlight.
No, that would have been wild. Can you imagine? Just absolutely stunting on his former team.
Hey, sometimes you just got to tip your cap. Anyway, okay. Twisting himself around the net, unbelievable.
Yes.
Play. And I mean, I can do a whole segment on this, obviously, but I do think there's an extent to which, remember, like, Heiskanen was already hurt when they executed the Mikko Rantanen.
Mm-hmm.
So when the Stars made the Mikko Rantanen trade, they knew that the right side of their defense was, like, as glaring and obvious an Achilles heel as when you're fighting, like, a boss in Star Fox, and they've got, like, a shining yellow indicator of where to shoot.
Yep.
And yet, they chase the upside. Like, forget building the most complete lineup to maximize our shot at a cup this year. Let's go. Let's get 9 years with this elite talent, a caliber of player that we've never had. And that when we lost to McDavid in the Stanley Cup final, or when we lost to Kucherov, in the Stanley Cup final, when we lost to McDavid in the Western Conference final, you know, when Jack Eichel ran roughshod over us, like, we didn't have. Let's go do that. Because that's who we keep bumping into and getting beat by, despite having these, you know, complete, strong, dark horse type contending rosters. Let's go have the guy. Let's go try to take a swing at landing the alpha dude, even at the expense of entering the season with, like, an incomplete roster that, hey, we might lose in round one. Like, this might not be our year, but it's worth it to raise our ceiling. And I think what's funny about this is, as the NHL moves to be even more star-driven in terms of shaping outcomes, making that type of trade, being willing to take, like, a on-paper step back to chase ceiling, sometimes hits right away, because, as I think this weekend served as a reminder, like, sometimes you're going to be down by 2 goals in the third period.
Yes.
And can you pull it out of the fire? Do you have the dogs you need, right, to fix those situations? Because if you can't, if you don't have that upside, you're going down. Like, you're not going to win. You're not going to win the 16 games over 2.5 months that you need to win the Stanley Cup. So I felt like that was an interesting lesson. And I do think there's sort of several really interesting ramifications of that if you unpack it and apply it to the Canucks.
I also just was trying to imagine, like, the psychic damage that would be inflicted on fans in this city if they were in Colorado's position.
Right.
And you had traded a player of Mikko Rantanen's, not just talent, but stature with the organization.
Yeah.
Right? Like, he won a cup.
Yeah, they all love him.
He was the definition of a core piece, we all thought, for the Colorado Avalanche. And you trade him, he bounces back into your division that season and then eliminates you in part with a third period hat trick to complete a comeback in Game 7. That is a cataclysmic series of events for a fan base and for an organization.
And I'd add this, like, you can't rebuild your team in midstream more impressively, right?
Yeah.
In terms of, like, finding all the right pieces and making it all fit and having all this depth than what Colorado did after contract negotiations with Mikko Rantanen fell apart. And still, right, you can do all of that work. Do you know how many primary points Martin Natchez had in this series?
One.
Two.
Yeah.
Right? And it's like, you can do all this work, land Brock Nelson and Charlie Coyle and, you know, look great on paper and down the stretch, and yet, you know, if one team has Mikko Rantanen and you don't, and maybe you did, but you don't anymore, it's tough, right? Like, you get just close enough for that caliber of player to break your heart.
Mm-hmm. And then on the other one, of course, last night, just a phenomenal spectacle in Winnipeg. The miracle comeback, Cole Perfetti scores with 2 seconds left to tie the game. That was their second empty net goal, or 6-on-5 goal of the game, to complete the 2-goal comeback, tied at 3. Adam Lowry scores in double overtime to win the series for the Jets.
Does he still have credit for that goal?
Adam Lowry?
Yeah, I'm convinced he didn't touch it.
That's interesting. I'd have to go back and check. But
I need to see it, because I watched the highlight, like, Zapruder film style.
Yeah.
And I was like, I don't think he touched it, but I forgot to check this morning. Anyway, the
still showing on the NHL website as Adam Lowry's goal from the Opiok.
The play leading to the tying goal, right? Where Nikolaj Ehlers, who bobbled the puck on the 3-2, 3-1 goal that felt like a real body blow for the Jets in real time at the end of the second period, the Faxa goal, bobbles the puck at the blue line, and they lose the zone because he's playing the point with, you know, maybe Morrissey would have been there if Morrissey was in, but he was not. So he's playing the left point. He bobbles the puck. Then he shanks a slap shot attempt after Adam Lowry wins a battle and gets it up to him. Lowry wins a battle again because he's an absolute plow horse.
Yes.
And he doesn't just win the what? Why are you laughing at that?
Somebody already texted him being like, I was really struck by Drance's use of the word plow horse on the weekend.
What? Plow horse is a tough animal.
Of course.
Yeah. He's a unit.
Boxer from Animal Farm.
Yeah. There you go. Leadership qualities, right?
Yeah.
The second battle that he wins, it's not just that he gets position and gets his stick on the puck, but he gets it to the point with zip. It's like a really nice play. The absolute nerve of Nikolaj Ehlers having flubbed the zone with 30 seconds to go and then whiffed on his first slap shot attempt to then be like, well, I'm going to try a cross seam pass. If that play doesn't work in his last appearance, most likely in a Jets uniform.
Yep.
I mean, that's literally his legacy. Like, no one would forget the time that Nikolaj Ehlers didn't shoot.
It's a Nick Ehlers legacy game in the bad way. In the most negative sense possible.
Why didn't you shoot?
Yep.
You know what I mean? Like, what? Why? If that play doesn't go off, you are laughed at for the rest of your life.
Mm-hmm.
But Nikolaj Ehlers is super cool. And he's just like, yep, back door. I don't know how Kyle Connor got enough on it. And then Cole Perfetti. We were trying, me and Dimitri watched the game together. We were trying to come up with like a comp for what we saw from Perfetti last night. And I wake up this morning and Dimitri's like, I finally got it. That was a Pavelski game.
Ah, the tip.
From Cole
tip
Perfetti.
Game. Yeah.
And it's like, yeah, that's dead on. Nailed it.
Two of the best tips you'll ever see. Like, just phenomenal.
Incredible hands on that young man. And yeah, I mean, the Jets survive. What a great, I think that was my favorite series.
Oh, that was the best series
for
sure.
That was the best series start to finish. And the drama of like Hellebuck just getting chased every time they went to St. Louis. And then him finding his game, like he was great in overtime after being incredibly shaky through seven games of regulation time, right? Like it was just like all series you were wincing at every single blue scoring chance. And then all of a sudden he looked like Connor Hellebuck, like not just making difficult saves, but making difficult saves look easy in the highest stakes moment of the Jets season. It was really cool to see.
My other big takeaway, or the thing I was left thinking about most after watching that game, and especially obviously the Cole Perfetti goal and the tying goals for Winnipeg, is just I feel like 6-on-5 execution has never been more important in the NHL in both directions, right? When you're pressing for the tying goal and when you're trying to close the game out as the team with the lead. And obviously we know there's more, you know, teams are more aggressive about pulling the goalie, right? So there's more 6-on-5 time and all of that. But it also feels like the gap between teams is bigger now than it ever has been. I think back to when I was growing up watching hockey, and even, you know, 15, 20 years ago, there was an element of randomness it always felt to 6-on-5, right? It's like, oh, hey, we're out of ideas, so we'll pull the goalie and, you know, hopefully we get some traffic in front of the net and maybe we'll score a goal. Now it feels like, it almost feels more like watching a 2-minute drill with a team down a touchdown in the NFL, right? Where it's like, this isn't just randomness. This isn't a Hail Mary. This is a chance to show that you are prepared for the situation, that you have the composure to make those plays like Adam Lowry and Nikolaj Ehlers did, right? That you know, you understand the situation, you understand all of the nuances. And I immediately thought of the Canucks Blues game in March when Brock Besser scored that goal with, what, 3 or 4 seconds left?
Yep.
And I thought that was an atrocious sequence for the Blues. I think I texted you actually immediately. I was like, they should be disqualified from playoff contention just on the basis of how poorly they played that 6-on-5 sequence. And they ended up getting disqualified from the playoffs ultimately because of a 6-on-5 situation. It's been an issue for Jim Montgomery teams going back to Boston. And, you know, I also think of like Edmonton tying the game in Game 4. In their series. That arguably swung the series, right? If LA closes that game out, if Quentin Byfield gets it out, they're up 3-1, they probably find a way to finish things off. Instead, boom, Edmonton's right back in it and they go on to win. I think of the Canucks last year in Nashville, Game 4, right? Like an incredible, ridiculous comeback in a game they had absolutely no business winning because they were able to execute it 6-on-5. It's a talent that if you're good at it, like it's legitimately swinging playoff series. It's almost to the point where it's something you should, if you're sitting down and trying to pick a, you know, pick the winners in round two here, you should factor it in. Like I remember watching Edmonton against LA and it's like, Edmonton's going to score here.
Yeah.
They're so locked in and LA is so not locked in. It's gone from being a coin flip situation to a situation you can exploit if you're locked in and you have the coaching and all of that to do it.
You ready for this? Number one team in the NHL. Goals against rate when leading and playing against a team. So this is goals against.
Okay.
When leading.
Yeah.
When the other team's pulled their goalie.
Okay. So this is the best or the worst?
This is the highest amount of goals against. So you don't want to be here.
You don't want to be number one. Is it the Blues?
It's the Blues number one.
Yeah.
Number one goals for team with your net empty trailing.
Is it the Canucks?
It's the Winnipeg Jets.
The Winnipeg Jets!
But you won't be surprised to hear this because I think the Canucks are pretty good at endgame.
Yes. Well, especially last season.
Well, they were great at it last season.
They were, like, phenomenal at it.
But they still were ninth in the league in goals for in that situation this year. However, they were third. Only Columbus and St. Louis were worse than them.
Yeah.
With their own net empty. With the other team's net empty.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's interesting because they had the knack for doing it, right? We talked about always about them being hard to kill, but they did suffer with the ability to kill games as well this year, whereas last year they were fantastic at that as well. But it's a combination of so many things, right? There's more opportunities for it because teams are pulling the goalies more often. Like you had five forwards out there for Winnipeg, right? So there's more chances for them to make plays. And I even think of, like, we've internalized, okay, sometimes you should just shoot for the empty net, and if you ice the puck, that's fine, but there's still situations where it doesn't make sense to do that and situations where you need to run time off the clock and all that, and I just think you can really tell the teams that are locked in now, and it's become more of a differentiating factor than I think it ever has before in the NHL.
Well,
at the
number one team in the league by a lot is the Florida Panthers in this area. Like in terms of chasing games, once their net is empty, the Panthers generate shots for, not goals though this year, but shots and attempts at a rate that's like breaks the scale relative to the other teams in the NHL. But there's a lot of other good teams still in the playoff mix. Vegas, Edmonton, Toronto, Carolina all rank in the top 10.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, I think you're right. I think this is increasingly important, especially in a world where teams are so good at exploiting screens. Offensive players are so good at manipulating goaltenders. It's just so much harder to hold a lead. Like, it's so much harder to hold a lead now. And, I mean, obviously we saw that shape the events this weekend to dramatic effect.
Like,
it's very good for the sport that killing a hockey game these days is not, like, rote.
Two goals against a really good team, and it's 3 minutes left, and they pull the goalie, it's like, you're not leaving. You're like, this is a live game here.
Absolutely.
Right? And you're right. It's an incredible thing for the sport, for the product. Okay, headlines here. I don't know how much we have to say on this, and maybe we can get into it later on in the show.
You're talking about the ownership news?
Yeah, I was just silencing my phone there. But yes, the ownership news. And of course, remember there was the report from Nick Kiprios that maybe there's speculation that the Canucks are considering selling the team, the Aquilini Group considering selling the team. The Canucks released a statement last week reading, in response to various media inquiries that we have received and due to a private family matter, Paolo has resigned from his positions with the team, that's Paolo Aquilini, and will be leaving the ownership group. The remaining owners take their role as stewards of this community asset with deep responsibility and pride and remain fully committed to bringing the Stanley Cup to Vancouver. This team holds great meaning for the family and is not for sale. There will be no further comments. So, not for sale, but one of the Aquilini family, Paolo Aquilini, leaving the ownership group. And the word that came to mind for me when I was thinking about this was Kremlinology, right?
Where, that, like, is the right word.
American intelligence officials trying to guess what Russia was doing based on, like, the personnel dealings of the Kremlin. It's like, well, this guy seems to be out of favor now. What's going on there? What does that mean? Like, your guess is as good as mine. You probably have a better guess than me, but, like, okay, Paolo Aquilini has left the ownership group. What does that mean for the Canucks? I don't know.
Well, I mean, we were talking about this last week that, you know, I was sort of selling on the uptick in rumors about the ownership group in part because, or the team being for sale in part because I thought it would take a change in family dynamics to create it. Well, it sounds like that's happened, right?
Yes.
So for what it's worth, more than anything on our Kremlinology score sheet, I think I would just, like, tick a box of, like, okay, I do think that these rumors at the very least were hinting at something material having changed. You know, the statement put out, I think, doesn't answer all of our questions, right? First of all, it's framed as like an active process. He's leaving as opposed
sure,
to he's
he
left.
He has left, sure.
The use of the word resigned. So does that just mean that there's no longer an active role in Aquilini Sports and Entertainment? Or does that mean there's been a divestment of stake or a splitting of stake among the family? I mean, it's a privately owned team. Like, we don't know. They don't have to report it. There's no sort of like it's not the Green Bay Packers. Yeah. There's no shareholder meeting at which we're going to be explained that where we're, you know, this is going to be explained to us. So I think that poses a pretty interesting question too.
Has he been bought out of the Craftsman style house in the west side
right,
of Vancouver?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. We don't know. Right. Like the statement is not clear on several key facts, I think, that would help us understand this a little bit deeper. Team's not for sale, they say, but there has been some sort of change in terms of family dynamics impacting the ownership and involvement of the brothers as it pertains to the operation of the team. We'll see sort of how this shakes loose. I think the real thing is, you know, the continued Volander standoff, Tockett leaving, and now ownership uncertainty all sort of hitting the Canucks in the, 2 weeks since the season ended?
Yeah.
I mean, the season ended on April 16th, and it feels like we haven't had a good Canucks news day the entire time, like in 2.5 weeks. Is that fair?
Yeah.
Like, there's been nothing accomplished. There's been nothing to be excited about or hang your hat on. It's kind of just been drama and uncertainty circling the drain with, I think, an increasingly, dour tone around the team, at least in terms of how the fan base is perceiving it. And I think this ownership thing, it dropping on Friday, the speculation that preceded it, the Hughes speculation that's accompanied Tockett's decision to walk in combination with some of Rutherford's previous commentary. Like, it just feels like there's this sort of cloud or shroud hanging over this organization at the moment that certainly sort of this does nothing to dispel. Right? Like, once this team starts making moves, at least optimistic fans will have something to grapple onto and talk themselves into and hope for. And it just feels like that side of the fan base is starving and you think? Like, restless.
That the 3-goal comeback against Dallas that's faded. You know what I mean? Was that the last like real feel good thing?
I mean, that was cool.
It was awesome.
Yeah.
I think that's it. All right, broadsheet around the league stuff. A few things we can whip through here and then maybe dive into in more depth later in the show. Elliot Friedman on the latest 32 Thoughts podcast saying that Adam Foote, he believes, has a serious chance, in his words, at becoming the next head coach of the Vancouver Canucks, cites the relationship between Foote and Quinn Hughes. And, of course, we've heard Quinn Hughes talk about Adam Foote's influence on him and his game and really on the whole Blue Line's performance here as well. Rick Dhaliwal throwing another couple of names. Todd Nelson, who, of
Let's
course,
go.
You've brought up, says Todd Nelson is in the mix. Also wonders about Luke Richardson, former head coach of the Chicago Blackhawks. And mentions Mitch Love is on the radar for a lot of teams. Doesn't specify necessarily the Vancouver Canucks, but it wouldn't surprise me if he is on the radar because I think he's a really strong candidate for a lot of different reasons.
And a BC guy.
And a BC guy. Dub experience as a head coach as well.
Quinnell. From Quinnell, though.
Yes.
So, look, the thing about Adam Foote is he has 1 year of head coaching experience, and it didn't go well. Right. And it was at the WHL
yes.
level. So that Kelowna Rockets team that Foote was the head coach of, I remember scouts being deeply disappointed by how conservative that team's game plan was. A lot of glassing out, not a lot of skills development. There was a lot of criticism, like to the point where when Foote was named assistant coach, I was like, OK, we'll see, because I know that a lot of the people who I trust that watch hockey really closely in this province were not huge fans of his work in Kelowna. Now, there's no question that he's been a massive success as an assistant coach in Vancouver, as sort of Tockett's guy running this defense, you know, Hughes's emergence, but also like the decision to put Hughes and Hronek together to sort of build that chemistry, the work you saw from You know, guys like Nikita Zadorov playing the best hockey of their careers here. Tyler Myers having had his two best seasons. So, you know, you can see the argument for Foot being having been successful here and being ready, I suppose, for a promotion. But this guy's never been a professional head coach. And like, he's never been a professional head coach.
We talk about Manny Malhotra's relative lack of experience and is he ready? Malhotra has significantly more coaching experience than Adam Foote.
Yeah,
Adam
7 years as an assistant.
Yeah, Adam Foote's coaching experience is the 1 year with Kelowna in the WHL, which, as you said, was not successful, and then the 2.5 years on Rick Tocchet's staff, where he did a really good job.
Really good job.
But Malhotra has assistant coaching jobs with two different NHL organizations and then the head coaching job this year with Abbotsford, so he does have more. So I get it. Look, you want to at least give your internal candidates the opportunity and talk to them and interview and all of that, but I don't think we should be looking at, well, Manny Malhotra is in the inexperienced bucket and Adam Foote's in a different one. It's like they're both inexperienced
candidates.
Oh,
no. Adam Foote's in a more inexperienced bucket. And I'd add this. The profile that I think makes sense to bet on, the Mitch Love, Todd Nelson profile, is elite American League head coach. Like that, I think if you want to land the next great coach, right, if you're not going to get the Cooper, you know, Mike Sullivan tier guys, Rick Tocchet would sort of be like in that tier, but at the bottom end of it, right? The top guys, then I think your best bet is to go and try to find the next Spencer Carberry, the next Bruce Cassidy, the next Mike Sullivan, the next Jared Bednar, the next, I already said Carberry. So anyway, I think that's the profile that we just see time and time again. The next Adam Huska, right? That's what I want to see in terms of what the Canucks do. Now, at least with Malhotra, you could say, hey, he might not be ready, but he fits that profile, right? At the very least, his 1 year as a head coach in the American League, he's managed high-end results.
Yeah.
So this is a guy who's on a, you know, accelerated development trajectory, and he fits, at least like if you squint, you can be like, he's the next one of those guys, even if we've arrived at that place a year or two ahead of schedule. Yeah, right? Like, genius level coach, we need to take the shot at him now. The profile that I'm usually skeptical of is up jumped assistant. Like, you can find so many of the sort of like the Phil Housley, the Bob Bugner, the like up jumped assistant who's never been an American League bench boss, who gets a chance coaching an NHL team and it doesn't go well. Right? Though that to me is like, though that profile, I just think Malhotra, of the internal candidates, I think both Foote and Malhotra are obviously very capable, intelligent people. I don't think I'd be like deeply critical of either.
Well, yeah, they've done really good work for the organization. So again, it makes all the sense in the world to talk to them, to interview them.
And they have tremendous leadership skills from a lifetime in hockey, right? But I think the bet on Malhotra makes a lot more sense to me than the bet on Foote, especially given, you know, that his experience as a head coach is as limited as it was, and most importantly, was not positive, right? Like, it's not something that I'm taking to the bank and being like, hey, whether he's ready or not, he's been a great head coach in the past. With Malhotra, you can say that. With Foote, you can't. That to me would be a pretty, like, would loom significantly in my thinking if I were advising the organization.
That's the whiteboard for today. Can't find the latest episodes of your favorite HGTV, Discovery, and Food Network shows? Rogers Xfinity TV has the newest seasons of the top-rated shows on these popular channels, while other providers are no longer including them in their TV lineup. If your TV provider doesn't carry these channels, you're missing out on new seasons of Celebrity IOU, Hometown, Beat Bobby Flay, Expedition X, and more. Don't be fooled by other channels pretending to be these networks you know and love. Get the latest with Rogers Xfinity TV at Rogers.com. We'll take a break. We will look ahead to round two of the Stanley Cup playoffs, which gets going tonight. Maybe take some of your texts, do some Canucks notebook clearing as well next here on Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650.